Episode 216 von Winter Day Hockey O'Clock. Jean Saint-Amand, Stürmer, Steinbach, Black Wings Linz.
Winter Day Hockey O'Clock.
In diesem Augenblick wird's jetzt richtig hitzig. Und die Scheibe kollert über die Linie.
Mittendrin statt nur der Ball.
Das ist unglaublich, was die vier zelebrieren. Leistung, an deine Leistung.
It is indeed a shame that it took so long to finally get him on Winter Day Hockey O'Clock. He's been one of the premier playmakers in the Winter Day Ice Hockey League since he joined. He's one of the sights to watch when you're attending a game of the Steinbach Black Wings Linz. He's a gifted scorer. He's one of the best shots in the league. He's tremendously entertaining. And he's finally here. Can't be thankful enough for you joining the show. It is, of course, Jean Saint-Amand. So glad to have you on Winter Day Hockey O'Clock.
Thank you very much, Martin. Good to be here.
Jean, so many things to be talking with you, obviously at the start of the year, obviously after the campaign that you're coming off of. Opening weekend is in the books. And for you and the Black Wings, it started with the home opener on Friday, a win against the Pioneers, obviously you with a goal and an assist, just a normal day at the office for Jean Saint-Amand. How important was it for you and the guys just to get that first one under your belts?
I mean, it's really good. Obviously, you got the training camp, which is a long one. It's like a month and a half. So you try to prepare, get ready for obviously the first game. And you never really know how. Like, you got the excitement in you, and sometimes it can be bad. You just try too much and in the wrong direction. But it was good to have it, the first win there, just to get it out of the way, like you said, and looking forward for the other ones. But didn't go our way in Farivar. I mean, I think we had our chances to score. I mean, the puck didn't go in, but we played a good game. I think we can build on that one. I think actually our game was probably better than the one we played against the Pioneers. So, sometimes it goes that way, but I think there's a lot we can learn from that one.
You have the luxury of playing for some of the best fans in the league, if not the best fans. And you also had the luxury of having a traveling fan base. So it doesn't matter if you played a preseason game on the road or at home, there were always a couple hundred and at home a couple thousand fans in the stands. Now that the games do count and now that the stands are full again, describe the feeling of getting out of the tunnel and seeing that those stands being full of fans who are indeed full with anticipation. How is that skating towards them to open the season?
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, I've never seen that fans going on the road and then they support you. Sometimes it's 4 or 5 hours away and you don't expect anyone to be there and you're up on the ice for a warm up and there's a bunch of people there. So it's really eye opening. And sometimes you're not feeling it or something and you see that on the road and you're like, wow, okay, these people like drove all the way down here, come see you. I mean, support you. And so it just gives you that little extra boost sometimes. I've never seen that in North America, obviously. Like, I don't know, it's not a thing, I guess, as much as over here. But yeah, that just tells you how the fans loves their team. And yeah, they're ready to, even on days off, on Sundays, I guess, nobody's working and they're driving. It's unbelievable. It's something that I'm sure that everyone on the team appreciates. And even at home, like you said, is sold out the first game. Even in preseason, we had a good crowd too. And it was sunny outside, 25. People probably want to go to the lake or something, get a tan in. So, but it just shows you how they're invested in their team and they want to be there in the lows, in the highs and lows. So it's really nice.
Let's just have this here one more time. Linz fans are indeed crazy because I think when you had your home opener during the preseason, I attended a game in Klagenfurt, if I'm not completely mistaken. And Klagenfurt had a great crowd with 1,500 people during preseason. Again, warm outside, tons of other stuff to do. And Linz clocked in at around about 2,000 people. I'm like, holy shit, Linz is different. And it's been different these past few years after a lot of turmoil. And we'll get to you as a person and as a player to help turn around this hockey program. But what's been turned around too, and that's one of the great sights to see again, is that the initial old band kind of is back together. It's you, it's Graham Knott, and it's Emilio Romig, who went through a long rehab, missed the entirety of last year. How is it for you to have him back on your line?
It's good. Yeah, I'm super happy. His shoulder is finally okay. Obviously, in preseason last year, he hurt his shoulder, needed surgery, so it was a step back for him. But I think he worked extremely hard during the last year to get it back together, and a lot of rehab. And it's tough mentally too. I mean, you know, from the beginning, you're not going to be a part of helping the team on the ice. Like, obviously, you try to be as supportive as possible outside the rink, but it's tough for him mentally. But he would always come in with a smile and try to make guys laugh. So it was good to see that, and it's really nice to have him back on our line. I mean, we've played 2 years together prior to his injury, and you could see that our first year we didn't do badly, and then on the second year we like found some chemistry. So I feel like it was going the right way. And then, yeah, unfortunately, last year he got hurt. But now I feel like we're starting to get back to where we were 2 years ago. And it's fun, really fun. And we know where we're going to be on the ice. So it's a little easier to play and make plays, obviously. So and with his speed, too, he brings that and that momentum. He can be physical and wins his battles. So it makes her job a little easier sometimes, and he's great to have around.
I want to get to the chemistry part in a bit. And speaking of Emilio Romig, we as broadcasters last year were tremendously fortunate that he unfortunately was injured, because during the playoffs we were able to nab him once or twice as a guest expert, especially during the incredible series against Graz and another great series against Klagenfurt. But now that he's back on the ice with you, now that he's back on the line that he, and especially with line mates that he was used to prior to being injured, was there kind of a process of re-acclimatization, getting to know each other again? Or did you already hit it off where you basically left off before his injury?
Probably took a couple practice maybe, but it didn't take really much time. I mean, it just got back together like this almost, and it was impressive. We didn't have to play 10 games, so that was fun. So it was quick, and right back where we were, and obviously we want to do even better.
Obviously, this program and podcast Wing Today Hockey O'Clock serves a purpose of educating the audience about the tremendous players that we're lucky enough to see and witness within the Wing Today Ice Hockey League. And you've been one of the best playmakers. I've already said that in the intro, that the past couple of years. It's now your fourth year in Linz with the Black Wings. You signed a huge extension during the summer. How have things change for you personally heading into year four as a Black Wing? What's different? What's the same? How good is it to know that there's been so much continuity the past couple of years for you, and you knowing where to go and what to do and what to expect in Linz?
It's been fun because we've had the same group, like you've said. We've had the same group of guys for almost, well, it's going to be our fourth year now together. So it's fun to know, to enter a locker room and, you know, most of the guys are the same one than last year. So you know what to expect, and you know what to expect on the ice from them too. So it makes your job a little bit easier. It's always fun to forget. But when you change the team completely, that's why it gets tough. Like, obviously off the ice, you got to start to know each other. Like, you start from zero, from scratch. But no, it's super fun. And that's why I signed an extension, is because we keep the same core pretty much for the past 4 years. So that was, I made the big difference there. And yeah, hopefully we can. And I felt like we've had progression too from our first year. It's not like we've stagnated or we're going backwards. So I feel like there's an improvement every year. And I feel like coaching staff and the management too are seeing that, and they're trying to improve the team a couple pieces a year and trying to get that right.
You've been to places in your career with huge turnover, basically a new team almost every year or every other year. And it's not only the core that's remained the same in Linz, it's also the coaching staff. And at times, messages from coaches do get a little stale if they try to do the same things all over again. Now, I know Phil Lucas fairly well. He's been a pundit on our NHL shows a couple of years ago. He's a dear friend. He's one of the smartest people in all of, not only hockey, but probably in all of Austria, period. And I was just wondering, how did his message change, and what he wants you to do? Or is it consistently, or has it been consistently the same over the past couple of years? Is year four under him, and was training camp number four under him different than training camp number one? And if so, how?
I wouldn't say it was that much different. I mean, now that they're tracking all our practices with GPS and stuff, so now they see like our training camp, how hard is it on our bodies. So maybe, yeah, I'd say that this one was a pretty hard one. So maybe change a few skating drills here and there, but no, he's been consistent, I'd say, most of the time. And yeah, I think it's a good thing too. So and usually on the first couple practices, not take it easy, but we wouldn't do any like stop and starts. Like, guys are starting to skate, haven't skated for a while sometimes, and it's just easier for the groins to turn and stuff. So he's played the game not long ago, and you can tell right away right there, and he's making just smart decision. So it helps us get back to it.
Give me an example in what kind of cases you can tell that he's played. What are instances where you go like, well, shit, he knows.
Yeah, sometimes, I don't know, if you go in a battle drill or something and he's like, yeah, you guys are not going 100% right now, he knows right away. He knows right away. He can't fake it. So, but yeah, he's just there to bring you back, and then trying to, at the end of the day, he wants us to get better as a player, and I understand that. And at the end of the day, I'll make the team better. So that's for the good of everyone.
Kind of piqued my interest when you said that practices are now GPS tracked. What does GPS data tell you about the player that you are and the player that you want to be?
What it does is actually tracks you on the ice. So it tells you how many kilometers you've skated during the game or practice. It gives you a... Yeah, for the fans that maybe don't know, yeah, it tells your heart rate from the beginning till the end. And then with that, they see a lot of data that says like how quick are your first three strides on the ice. Yeah, how long was your heart rate in the red limit, and how quick you can recover from that high heart rate to go back down to like normal-ish. So it tells them a lot, and it's easier for them, I think, to plan practice so they know like what our body went through the day before, what we need to do today to be ready for the next day. So that's just, yeah, it's a lot of data, and yeah, that's what the world's turning into now, eh? A lot of numbers here and there.
But Are you a stats person, or are you more a kind of feel kind of guy? Are there data points that interest you, that you want to know, that help you maybe change your game a little bit? Or does it have to, for the lack of a better word, just gut feeling kind of stuff, does it have to feel right for you? Stats person or feel person?
I'm more of a feel person, I'd say. Like, I know there's a bunch of stats out there you can look into, you can watch that all day. But it's, at the end of the day, it's a gut feeling, like you said. And yeah, for me, mostly probably the only stat that I look at on my personal data is the puck battle that I've won in a game in D zone or in O zone. And yeah, that tells a lot about my game at the end of the day. So I know right from that data if I had a good game or if I've lost too many one-on-one battle.
I want to dig a little deeper as regards the person and your upbringing. You are French-Canadian. You grew up in Quebec in Ligue 2. And if I'm not completely mistaken, it's a city that doesn't really exist anymore because it's... let me just get this straight. Repentigny, which kind of was included in or added to a bigger city. So first of all, did I get this correct?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a city. I don't know if you'd still be able to call it suburban Montreal, because it is indeed 50 kilometers away from the biggest city in Quebec. And I've had the good fortune of strolling the streets of Montreal, which is one of the most beautiful cities on the North American continent that I've ever been to. But how is it growing up in Quebec and being a hockey player? Granted that this is by far, and that's a capital, by far the biggest sport in Quebec.
Oh yeah, like you said, it is the biggest sport. It's not even close. Like, soccer doesn't even close. American football is not even close. Even baseball. So yeah, it's all about hockey. I mean, you go to school and every guy in your class is probably playing hockey at one point. And My mom had two daughters at first, and then she knew if she had a boy, she was going to put him in hockey right away. So I didn't get a choice here. It was right away, put the skates on, and then, yeah, go at it.
You played in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League, which is one of the three big ones in Canada, alongside the Western Hockey League and obviously the Ontario Hockey League. But... And you're kind of the person now has to validate that statement or disagree with it. But I've heard a lot of times that hockey in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League is different than one in Western Hockey League and Ontario Hockey League. Is that the case? And if so, how does it differ? Is there a certain, let's just call it, Quebecois style of playing hockey?
It's hard to compare because obviously they don't play against each other much. I mean, obviously just in the Memorial Cup, which you get the best teams of every leagues. But I'd say when I was playing there, obviously it's been a long time already, but when I was playing there, when we went to the Men's Cup, I thought the WHL was, the guys were a little bit bigger probably than the two other leagues. They were bigger. They had more like the little bit of old school style of hockey, more physical, more dump the puck and then go on the forecheck kind of. But and the Ontario Hockey League has always been a skills hockey. The guys are really skills there, and I thought for me the Quebec League was the fastest league skating wise. So that's what I thought when we went in the Men's Cup. And it was a great experience, obviously, to compare yourself with other players. But that's how I see it. I'd say the WHL is probably the most physical. And then I think the OHL is the more skill league, more playmaking league. And I think the Q is the highest pace on the skate.
first of all, I should back this up a little bit because it was called the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League, and I still have to get used to the term that it's the Quebec Maritime Junior Hockey League. Still the same abbreviation with QMJHL, but just not that flowy as the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League used to be. But again, Quebec Maritime Junior Hockey League, and it's interesting that you mentioned the skating and the speed that goes along with it, and that kind of matches what I've been hearing from many people, that it's an incredibly skilled junior hockey league, and that there is indeed an emphasis on skating. And so many people do forget, yes, it's a sport where you do have to shoot the puck, but you have to be able to reach the puck to win the races, and the essence of this is obviously the skating. And that's something where I don't want to be too bullish on junior programs here, but that's probably an area where there's still incredible room for improvement. How much emphasis is being put on skating and learning it the proper way in juniors in Quebec, and even before that?
Yeah, I'd say it starts before that. Usually when you start playing like high level at 12, 13, usually you do your season, and then after the season, obviously you got all summer to train and then work out for the next one. But when you're 13, 14, parents would put their kids in the skating clinic, and that was from Monday to Friday. They're not cheap, that's for sure, not cheap at all. So it was expensive, so not everyone would go to them, but I think it was a great thing for me personally. We'd go on the ice for probably an hour 30, no pucks, just skating. And most of the time it was a girl teaching us how to skate, this figure skating coach, which they can skate incredibly. And they were trying to work with us on our edges and on our pushes. So it was a really good thing for me to practice that. And I think it helped me a lot along the way.
How much of what you are as a hockey player is skating, and how much is the rest of it? Is what you are able to do 60% based on the way you learn how to skate? Is it 70%? Is it 80%? Is it 50, and the other 50 are a skill? Or is it 50% skating, 40% skill, and 10% brains? Or is it all brains? What's the constitution of the hockey player Sean Saint-Amand?
I haven't thought about that question. I'd say 60% of the skating. I mean, you have the puck, what, maybe not even a minute in a game on your tape. So at the end of the day, you're skating a lot. And obviously it's important to be able to be fast from point A to point B. And I worked on it a lot when I was younger. So yeah, I'd say 60% is my skating abilities. And say probably in my shot, I'd say probably 20%. And the rest, I'd say, the brain. I'll give a 20% of the brain.
So there you go. The hockey IQ gets a 20% rate as well. At what point did you have the feeling, being a good skater, having a great shot, and being very smart with your choices on the ice too, that you might indeed have a career in this, that you might indeed have a chance of turning pro?
It was probably after my second junior year that I was I saw the progress after my first year and to my second year. And then when I finished my third year in junior after playoff, I got an offer to go play pro at 19. It was a big decision. I wasn't sure if I was ready to jump in pro hockey right away or play an extra year in junior, because you can play at 20 years old. So I decided, I was talking with my agent at that time, and we decided it was better for me to go turn pro right away. So I went pro, and then this is where you see the difference between, yeah, boys and men right there. Pro hockey, guys are stronger, and especially in battles one-on-one, this is where it's the biggest thing. It's speed, obviously, is faster, but I'd say most of the time is in the corner if you can win your battle. Obviously, when you win your battle against a 16 years old or against a 25 years old man, I mean, it's a different story. So, but yeah, that's after my third year junior. I wanted to go pro hockey. And then after my first year in pro hockey, I was like, yeah, I think I got it. And then I can improve from there and then see where it takes me.
I'm sure hundreds of thousands of players have gone through the same process. And you said you had your doubts, or you weren't sure if you wanted to go pro and if you were ready. What were kind of the things that you, or the doubts where you thought, well, am I really ready to go pro from junior to pro?
It was obvious, mostly I'd say, yeah, if you're strong enough to go right away. I mean, because, yeah, the speed, yeah, it is faster. I mean, the shots, and at the end of the day, the same thing a little bit. But it's mostly if you're ready to, because obviously you go from junior to pro. In junior, you're probably the top line playing power play to PK. And now you turn pro, you're the youngest guy out there. Obviously, you're not going to get that much ice time, probably. So it's obviously mentally as well. So you got to be strong mentally to be ready to accept that role and not discourage yourself, and being able to try to take that and then grow from it, and being able to work even harder to get more ice time and then get your seat that you wanted from that junior team you had.
Now, turning pro also meant for you to leave Quebec. I mean, you'd played for Val d'Or, for 6 hours, I think, away from Montreal when you were in the QMJHL. But going to San Antonio, going to Colorado, we're talking about many hours spent on planes. How much of a culture shock was it for you going from the safe haven kind of that you knew that's Quebec to North America and to the middle of nowhere? Well, it's probably rude to call it the middle of nowhere, but to San Antonio and Colorado, which probably aren't the destinations number one if you're intending to go to the US. How different was it?
Obviously, in junior, I was, like you said, I was probably 6 hours away from home. So, and we would play a lot around Montreal and Quebec area. So my family would be able to come see me play in different rinks over there. So I would see them probably once every 2 weeks, maybe. And they would come to Val d'Or, say, once or twice a year. So that was fun. I could see them actually like a couple of times during the season. So that was cool. After game, even though you only had like 20, 30 minutes before the bus leave, you could chat it out a little bit and get what's going on back home. So that was nice. And then when you turn pro, yeah, it's far. Yeah, I drove it, I think. No, that was my second year. Yeah. But it took me 27 hours driving over there. So it was a hike. But yeah, in Colorado, it was really beautiful. Actually, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Austria with all the mountains. And even in the summer, it's 25 outside. You look like a little further and you can see mountains with snow on it. So it was beautiful over there. And then I played, yeah, up and down in San Antonio in Texas, which is, yeah, I was far away from Colorado as well. Now you're in Texas, you're close to Mexico. It's, it's a different atmosphere. It's really warm out there. And, but it was fun. We had a good group of guys at that time too. And, but I love the city. It was a beautiful city. It's just, yeah, it's a different culture than Canada, but people were really welcoming there as well.
obviously, when you were with the Colorado Eagles, and that's one of the premier programs or better programs, at the very least, it used to be in the East Coast Hockey League. They're located in Loveland, Colorado, and the place or the city is at an elevation of 1,500 meters. You would be hard pressed to find lots of places where there's this hockey played at such an elevation. Probably Davos in Switzerland would come to mind here first. How was it for you playing at elevation? How long did it take you to properly get used to just the thin air and everything that goes with it?
It took you at least a week. Yeah, if you go from summer straight to Loveland, Colorado, you go on the ice and you're asking yourself like, what's going on here? Looks like I didn't work out the whole summer. Like I can't even breathe. So yeah, it took a week probably to get here, long as it's like in that thin air, like you said. But I'd say I thought it was an advantage too. When teams would come over, they weren't familiar with that. So I think we had an advantage on that at that point. Yeah.
You played 4 years in the American Hockey League, in the East Coast Hockey League, and you already said that you were kind of bouncing around. And if we add up the team total over those 4 years, you played for six different organizations. And that's usually a roadmap that leads a lot of people to Europe, because over there in Europe, they might just hang on or stick to one organization. How was it for you personally to play for that many organizations? Did you embrace it because you saw many parts of many different parts of the North American continent, or did you secretly, and I mean, you got the long-term security now in Linz, wish for a place that you be calling home for more than maybe a year or two?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, you bounce around, but at the end of the day, it makes you see the world as well. You see North America a little more. Some places you probably would never go if it wasn't for hockey. So you see a couple of things here and there. It's fun. It's just, it's not that easy sometimes to meet newbie, obviously new coaches every time, new team. So you got to start from the beginning every time. But yeah, I've been in all the organization I've been to. They were great, and I haven't had any problem. And I'm now getting a little bit older. I like not to move my suitcase too much. I like to stay in one place, and Linz has everything I need, and people are so welcoming and great. So it's, I don't know why I would leave this place.
The one thing or two things that always struck me, and I want to separate this question into two parts, is when you came over, you already had a championship pedigree, and there are so many hockey players and so many different levels that are never lucky enough to eventually hoist a trophy. You came as a bearer and winner of two Kelly Cups and one QMJHL. Trophy after your North American career. If you look back on those years, is there ever a point where you go like, Jesus, how lucky I am that I've already been able to be part of three championship winning teams?
No, that's true. And we just we had, especially in the East Coast, which is a lot of ups and downs. People go from the HL to the East Coast, and you have the same team the next week, you might have five different guys. So it's a lot different. But we had really my first year and second years, we actually won it back to back. But we had great teams, and it was a lot of fun, and the organization was great. So at the end of the day, all the older players would want to, let's say they're 28, 29, they wanted to go to Colorado to play there because they knew that organization was A1. So that helped us, brought some good veterans. And then I was a little younger. I was in my first year pro, and it was good to be able to jump in there and help. And I was learning a lot from the older guys on how to, obviously it's a lot of games too in playoff. It was a lot of learning on how to take care of your bodies there, and guys would be they would be banged up too sometimes, shoulder and stuff, and they just went through it, and that just shows you how the guys are willing to go through to win that cup, and that grows on you when you see that at a young age.
What people over here probably don't know is how grueling a schedule in the East Coast Hockey League can be. And as you pointed out, learning to understand how to treat your body and maybe play through a little injury or two. What's the one thing that playing in the East Coast Hockey League, where you don't only have back-to-backs, you sometimes have three and four, especially when you go on the road or something like that. What did playing in the East Coast Hockey League tell you or teach you about your body, treatment for your body, and what your body needs?
It's a good grind in the East Coast Hockey League. Like you said, it's probably a couple, three games in three nights. So you play on Friday nights at 7. You come back home after, play Saturday night at 7 too. And then on Sunday, you play an afternoon game at 2 p.m. After that game, I'm telling you, your body's just shutting down. You got nothing left. And when I was playing there, we only had three lines also. So we had three lines, and then we had an extra forward, so we would have 10. And then, yeah, so you play a lot of hockey, a lot of minutes, a couple 25 minutes night. But at the end of the day, it teaches you that sometimes, even though you're drained, you think you're drained, you got nothing, the body is really well made, and you always have something in the back, and you always got legs, even though you don't think you have it. You just got to find it that night. Sometimes it takes more time, but you ended up finding it and you go through it.
So nights where you have 21 minutes of time on ice, against Fiava, seems like a vacation compared to 3-3 with the East Coast Hockey League. when your North American tenure ended, and that's one of the things I was never able to properly figure out. Your first destination in Europe happened to be Gheorgheni in Romania. Now, there are a couple of gateway leagues, and I'd say the Winter Day Ice Hockey League is a gateway league too, or a stepping stone league, because a lot of first-time North American talent comes into the league, and if they're doing well, they're moving on to greener pastures and bigger leagues. But Romania normally isn't considered to be a stepstone league. There's still good players there, and one of the former Linz greats in Sebastian Pichet, he's still going strong in Brasov, if I'm not completely mistaken. So there's talent there, but young and up and coming Jean Saint-Amand gets to Romania, and it's his first destination in Europe. Why?
The reason behind that was COVID had happened the year prior, so the season ended early. We didn't play playoffs, so I think in March or something, the season was done. So we went home, obviously, COVID lockdown and everything. And the next season that was coming up, the East Coast and the AHL wasn't going to play until after Christmas. So there was nothing going on. You had to stay home, work out on your own, and do your thing. And I knew the coaches that was going there, and he called me and he's like, "Hey, would you want to go and stuff?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, sure. I mean, I want to play hockey. I want to play some games." So I was like, "Yeah, I'll go." And I knew the coaches, so I was like, "Yeah, I will be fine." And then, I got there and he got fired not long ago after that. So, yeah, I got to, he left me there. And, I was like, "Oh, I'll come back after Christmas and I'll go play it back in the East Coast and I'll be all right." And I ended up having a good time there either. So I was like, "Yeah, I'll stay there and grind it out for the year and go from there."
I was referring to the word culture shock a little earlier. Growing up in Canada, especially in Quebec, then going to the rough and tugged Midwestern area with Colorado and spending some time in Texas, that's very different too. Then to Romania, a country and especially a league not a lot of people are too familiar with, even in Austria, even though it's not too far away. What's the one thing that kind of struck you in Romania or playing in the league that was different, that made you go, I didn't expect that?
There was a couple rinks that were in not so great shape. So you would show there and you're wondering, oh, what's going on here? Are we playing here tonight? So that was probably the number one thing. Yeah.
You gave it another shot going over back to Canada, playing games in the American Hockey League, the East Coast Hockey League again, but then eventually landed in Linz, and that's the place where you spent the longest time consecutively as a hockey player, as a hockey pro. Why the back and forth, and why eventually the decision to go back to Europe?
A lot of back and forth, I'd say. North America is obviously, as a hockey player, you want to play in the highest level as you can. So you would try to play in the American Hockey League, and sometimes you get sent down in the East Coast. And after a year, sometimes they tell you like, we don't see you in our future and stuff. So what you do is you turn around, you try to find another team that you can have a way to access the American Hockey League where you think you might have the best chance. So that's why you move a lot in North America and pro hockey. And I decided to give it another shot in Europe after I had an injury before I came over here, and I didn't play any game that year. And I wanted a certain contract with Laval and Trois-Rivières where I was playing, and they wouldn't offer me that contract. So I just waited, and then Linz showed up. My agent called me, and I was like, yeah, I'm ready to give it another shot. I felt like I've heard so many good things about Europe hockey, and I felt like I maybe didn't see all of it when I was playing in Romania. So I was ready to give Europe a good second chance.
What was Linz's sales pitch like? And maybe considering that this was the year, like the year you came to Linz in the 2022-23 season, that was also the year where the entire organization had hit the reset button. It was President Peter Nada who had taken over. It was Phil Lucas who was appointed head coach, obviously club legend, number retired, hanging under the roof. You and a couple of others being there, they trying to acquire and assemble a core, and a core that's still in place to this day. But what was, again, the sales pitch from Linz to you that made you not even consider the offer, but made you go like, okay, this is where I want to go?
Before I came here, I was playing with Baudouin that actually played in Linz. I don't know if you remember him, the defenseman. So, and he's from Quebec. And I asked him, obviously, when Linz called, I asked him, what do you think? And he came to Linz in those rough season with different management and different coaches. So he told me the city was great. Fans were great. So he just told me, I think they're changing the management right now. I think it's going to be a good thing because they went from, I think, dead last. And then he said, management's going to be new coaches. And he's like, yeah, if I was you, I would go for it. You start from scratch. You're trying to build a new foundation. And the pitch probably mostly came from him.
When was the first time, or do you remember the first time meeting Phil Lucas, and what was your impression of him?
That was a couple of years ago already. First time, I thought he was a player.
Yeah, he's still looking very fit, yeah.
He's in great shape, so I was like, yeah, he's a player. But no,
Yeah, first thing I thought was, he cares about people. He's asking you a question. Obviously, he wants to make sure you're fine, that you're all set up in your apartment. Whatever you need, he's going to help you to get it. So, yeah, before hockey, he wants to make sure everybody's comfortable and their family and wife or kids that are all set up. And that shows you how he is as a person.
The interesting thing is, and we ran through the last 25 years of league history, there are not a lot of French Canadians that kind of were part of the league for more than 6 or 7 years. At the end of your current contract, if you indeed stay in Linz for the entirety of that contract, you will have been in Linz for 6 years. And that's a sweet spot, because only a handful of French Canadian players have been in Austria and in this league for at least 6 years or longer, and they're all greats. But back in the day, and we're talking about maybe 10, 15 years ago, when a lot of organizations tried to bring in French Canadian players left and right, I kept hearing, well, handling of French Canadian players is a little different. They are, quote unquote, a different breed. I never really was able to put the finger on it. But again, data tells you it's not very common that French Canadian players stay for such an extended amount of time in our league. Why do you think is that? Or is that a cliche or kind of a prejudice that French Canadian players are different than other North American players or other import players?
I don't think they're different. I think everyone could stay here and then play a few years and not have a problem with it. But I think maybe the biggest challenge with that is because they got the French league in France. So when people have wife or kids and they got to start going to school, I mean, I think it's a little easier to go to France, play in that league, so your kids learn French. So I think that's probably the biggest reason why people wouldn't stay for that long, probably. That's my bet.
And you're a prime example of a French Canadian being just a tremendous talk and tremendous interviewee, and obviously you being bilingual, English and French. How's your German coming along?
My German could be better.
But that's the thing, you don't really need to learn German, because everybody on the streets nowadays speaks proper English. It would have been harder like 30, 40 years ago, where you would kind of forced to start learning and understanding German. But is there actually a need of being able to talk German or understand German?
In Linz, I don't think there's a need. I think if you go to a restaurant, if you go to a pharmacy or a grocery store, you can get by with English. I think it's more out of respect from the fans and people try to learn the language that you're playing in. It's the same thing with the French Canadian. They're expecting Nick Suzuki to learn French. So I don't know how it's going, but yeah, that's just, I think it's out of respect from the fan and trying to learn a language. It's not easy when it's a third language. I mean, it starts to get a lot, but Phil speaks so many that it's crazy.
He does indeed, but for you, maybe there is a road where you'll eventually wrap your head around German. Problem is, it's not really nice to the ears, and it's awfully hard because you got three different genders, and if you don't grow up really understanding der, die, das, where in French you just have le, hola, and in English we just have D or A, that's incredibly difficult. So I don't really envy you in that regard. Where I do envy you is that you've had the good fortune of playing with one of the best centermen that we've had in recent years, with Graham Knott. And I've already brought up Emile Romig, who was a pundit on a couple of our shows last year, and I made him talk on the chemistry that you two have built, that you two have, that you two are feeding off. Looking back on your career, how special is it to have someone like Graham Knott, who's not only always there, but also always producing, and who, and it seems from the outside, knows you inside out? How special is that relationship that you two have on the ice?
Yeah, I mean, I've never played with a centerman that long. Usually, if I stick with a centerman for 1 year, I'm probably not seeing him the year after. So, but yeah, now it's our fourth year here, so it's special. It's something you don't see that often, and it translates in our game. I think we know what we're gonna do on the ice. I think a little bit. We know our what. Like, what's the maybe the weakness of the other ones, so we can try to help him in certain ways. So, but yeah, he's got so much poise with the puck, and he can find you on the ice even though he didn't see you. He knows where you are, so that's something. Sometimes you don't expect a pass, and he saw you. I don't know how, and then he finds you in the back door and open net. So, it's been fun though. It's been. It helps you want to get better. You try to pick a few things from him to get better as a player, and hopefully better as a line too. And obviously it translates to maybe a couple more goals for the team. So no, but it's been really fun.
How much of what you have is like a natural connection, and how much of what you have is based on hard work? How many extra sessions do you spend after practice, extra hours talking about stuff, watching video? How does one have to feel about or think about the connection that you've built, the rapport that you built?
Yeah, I think our first year, our first few games, we weren't connecting as much as we would like and as we were hoping. And after a few games, obviously, we started building that. But I think our speed and I think his vision helps us a lot. And obviously, we talk a lot about plays that we want to make. And when we make a mistake, we talk to each other and try to find a way to do it differently the next time. And but I think the biggest thing is we're never yelling at each other. We're never saying bad words or anything. So at the end of the day, we're just trying to build the other one up too. And that helps us keep our confidence, I think, and help the line.
You now have 160 games in the Winter Day Ice Hockey League under your belt. You scored 148 points, and probably the most impressive and your best stretch happened to be in last year's playoffs. That, of course, ended at the very least a game too early in Klagenfurt. You were one game away from reaching the finals, and you were on a tear. You scored 11 goals during the 14 playoff games. You were one game away of tying the league playoff goal record, and that was and that record is held by a man who advanced to the finals. So everybody was like, what has gotten into Sean Saint-Amand? And remember doing a couple of on-ice interviews with you as well, because you were always there when Linz needed a goal. You were always there when something had to happen. If you now look back on that kind of magic carpet ride, those month-long the month-long intensity and everything that went well for you, why did it click so well during last year's playoff campaign for you?
Yeah, that was crazy playoffs. That was so much fun. I mean, and even as a fan, I'm sure for both teams, it was probably a good time too. So many overtimes and stuff. It was the craziest playoff I've ever done in my life. But it was, yeah, it clicked. But I think the team was playing well. I think we took a step in playoff. Team was clicking, and then I was just trying to bring good intensity and trying to get to the net and try to get rebounds and stuff. And And obviously, guys were finding me sometimes on the back door. But yeah, I wasn't missing much at that time. But it was a great feeling just to be able to help out. And I remember the biggest thing is, as a team, we didn't panic one bit, not even when we were losing by one with 3 minutes left. No one was panicking. We just kept our composure, and that's fun when no one starts yelling left and right, and just stay focused, stay on the grind. And yeah, it happened a few times, and that was a great moment, and that'll be more moments I'll never forget.
This not panicking piece, how much of that does come from the coaches? How much of that is the team and the leadership group that kind of has that or puts that constant reminder out, don't panic? Where's it coming from?
Obviously, it starts with the coach. If they start yelling left and right, yelling at the referees for a bad call or something, it just brings everyone a little nervous. Maybe they grip their stick a little bit more. They miss a pass after that or something. So I think it starts from the coaches. And after that, you got the older guys that are trying, even though sometimes you don't have the game you wish you had and things are not going maybe your way, you still want to bring something to the table. And if that's just by being sometimes more composed and just trying to stay more calm and help the bench too, that's what you got to do. And it helps a lot for the younger guys too. I think they can learn a lot from that.
As we're inching closer to the 1 hour mark, I only have two more questions, and I'm incredibly happy that you've already taken so much out of your valuable time to join the program. The series in the quarterfinals against Graz, it will go down in league history, and this league is not really known for creating headlines on an international level, and if it does, it's usually for all the wrong reasons. But your quarterfinal series against Graz last year was labeled a world record series because no best of seven series had gone to six consecutive overtime decisions. We've looked at all the top leagues in the world. We didn't find one single series that fit that criteria. How much did your inbox light up during or your WhatsApp or whatnot light up during the series that got crazier and crazier with every game played?
Yeah, I got a few messages, not just from my family, from people back home too. You were watching that, from people that I played with, and they're like, Jesus, like, you guys must be tired. Like, you guys are playing like 25, 30 minutes a game easy, and you're doing it all again in 2 days. So, but it was so much funny. It was a lot of fun. And like I said, probably for the fans, it was probably a great show. Like, you're paying a certain amount of money for a ticket and you're seeing almost two games in one. You see six periods of hockey. I mean, it doesn't get better than that, does it?
And it was a spectacle for the media as well. I will bear witness or be judge of that. But as you were talking about being tired, did the tiredness ever set in, or is it just playoff mode where you just have to keep functioning? Was there ever a time where you felt like, oh, please let this be over?
No, I mean, you're such in it. You've put so much effort in it from game one to game six. Now you get to game seven. You just want to win it. So you find that energy and somehow you find it and you go out there and give it all. And next thing you know, you win that series and you got to do it all over again in 2 days in Klagenfurt. So you got to be able to switch your mindset real quick. All right, we won. That's nice. But next morning, you got to think about the next series, get ready. And it's a lot of fun, obviously, when you win. But it teaches a lot about yourself and what you can go through and what are your limits.
An incredible playoff run that will remain with Linz fans for a very, very long time. But as the core has remained together, and there have been some key additions, obviously, as regards to forwards and the defense. What are the lessons learned from last year's playoff run that will help you for this campaign? What can you take away that maybe helps you to get not over the hump, but to take another step into the direction that kind of Linz was used to, always competing for the semis and from time to time being in the finals? Indeed, what did 2024-25 teach you that will help you, hopefully for a lot of Linz fans, achieve that goal of reaching the finals?
I think the biggest thing is we gotta be physical too. I think we brought a couple of guys in that's gonna help with that. I think we're gonna be a more physical team this year, and that's gonna help us. But at the end of the day, I think we took some experience from last year, and obviously we've got the same core, so that's gonna help us too. And we know what it takes. Obviously, when time gets hard and you got to help each other out. But I think if we bring a little bit more physicality to our game this year, I think that's going to help us to maybe go through that next round.
And that will be music to Linz fans' ear. They'll be able to see you this upcoming Friday against the Vienna Capitals. Wishing you and the team all the best for that endeavor. Thank you so much for being on the program. It's a pleasure watching you play hockey. It's great to know that you'll be here for a couple more years, and I'm really, really thankful that you joined Winter Day Hockey Club. Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you, Martin. Thanks for having me. It was a great time, and hopefully I'll see you in the rinks this season, and wish you a good rest of your day.
Win today, hockey, O'Clock.
Kurz durchatmen bei diesem Wahnsinn, und das ging rasend schnell. Der Traum vom Finale ist erfüllt. Mittendrin statt nur dabei.
Fans, stimmungsvoll und hoffnungsfroh.
Nice move, another nice move.